what Dr. Hislop tries to do is to take advantage of this rare opportunity that Swami gives him to get answers to questions for all of us back here and all across the world. In just a couple of months, he will reach a period in his life, a milestone, his 90th year. Nevertheless, he displays the vigor, the intensity, the determination of that same 16-year-old kid who set out to try to find out about God. As you see in your program, he was given by Baba the responsibility of starting the Psi organization in North America, including the United States, Canada, and South America. He continues now to travel around the globe, even at a moment's notice. And when he goes to a place like Australia, for example, he's there for 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. And of course, they want to take full advantage of his presence. And so he's making 15, 16, 17, 18 different talks in a very short span of time. He just has tremendous energy, but of course the reason he has all of this energy is because it comes directly from the Lord, and he's able to get it to come directly from the Lord because of his intensity and the fact that he practices what it is that we're always talking about. I could go on and on and on and on and on, and we'd love to talk about Dr. Hislop because he's such a gift to us from Baba, but I would be remiss because I would be taking up his precious time. So let's all welcome Dr. John Hislop.
Probably the only thing that I can say for certain today is that I have no possibility of living up to Bill's introduction. none whatsoever. I'm really very glad to be here with you today because this is sort of a favorite stamping ground of mine. I think it's 7 years since I was here last. But prior to then, I think every 2 years I came for quite a long time. But then the organization started to grow. There were more and more regions, and each region then started to have its own conference. So I had to move around here and there, and so I couldn't come here for quite a long while. But I'm very, very glad to be here again. Our topic, of course, is Swami and his teachings. The Shankaracharya of Kanchi spoke very well of Swami. You know, Shankaracharya, when he was alive, established, I think it was 5 critical temples at specific points in India where they could yield the greatest influence. And so this is the Shankaracharya, or the Shankara teacher of Kanchi. And he said that when there appears a man of great dignity and truth, full of compassion, full of love, full of sympathy, then people believe him the moment they set eyes on him. And they accept his teachings because they are sure that teaching set forth by such a man could not be other than true. So that is what he said about us. And of course, we know that's true of Swami, and far, far, far more than that. Swami is every place at all times. He's the Lord of the universe, the Lord of love, and omnipresent at all times. That means that he is here in this room now, without any doubt. I just one story to illustrate that, because it's so much to the point. The McDowells. The McDowells, Mr. McDowell, Mrs. McDowell, and Ron live on a small farm in Kentucky, some miles out of town. And it was their custom to, for a couple hours every afternoon, to go into the house and meditate. They also had a dog, of which they were very fond. And one day the dog disappeared. And a couple of days later, a new dog came, so they adopted him. And when the time came for meditation, the dog was put into the garage by Mr. McDowell, and both doors in the garage is locked. Both doors locked. And so then they went in and had their meditation, and when they came out, there was the dog at the bottom of the steps, jumping up and full of joy. And Rodney and Mrs. McDowell went down to greet the dog. But Mr. McDowell himself, who was not the premier devotee of the family, as is often the case, started to walk down and sort of leaned against the balustrade of the balcony, looked at the dog, and said sort of under his breath, sotto voice, "It's got to be Swami." Well, the family paid no attention. Who pays attention to father nowadays? And it was, then I was in India some 3 years after that. And for the first time, the McDowells also came to India. And we were called in for interview at the same time, the McDowells and my wife Victoria and myself. Those of you who have been in interview know that Swami likes to say something to everybody, so they'll feel at ease, not feel strange. So he says, "Who are you? What's your name? Where are you from? What do you do?" You know, so he didn't know all those things beforehand anyway. But to put the person at ease. So the McDowells were sitting in chairs, and right next to them were three Indian ladies sitting on the floor. And so after talking to them, he moved on to the three Indian ladies and bent down and said something to them in a voice that nobody could hear. It was a private statement. So Mrs. McDowell, observing this, as a lady, wondered that maybe he was talking about us. And so when the interview was over, Mr. McDowell followed these three Indian ladies out of the room, and she said to them, "Excuse me for asking, but was Swami talking about us to you?" And the Indian lady said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes. He said, they think I'm a dog." And mind you, mind you, that was 3 years after the event. And what did it show? On that little insignificant farm in Kentucky, where these two people and the dog were, Swami was there. Of all the places in the world, why in a small farm in Kentucky? He was there. So he's every place at all times. And you can certainly be sure that he is here. About the topic for today, which is in a way about Vedanta. Swami said that to his devotees, that now is time for you to study something about Vedanta. He said the grammar school days and the high school days are over, and you're now in the college days. So, something about Vedanta. Even though Swami is the Lord of Love, and both he and Krishna agree that devotion is the fastest and most rapid path to union with God. Now, he also said that were you to take a regular person from the world, and with the greatest care and interest, explain to that person about Vedanta, one not two, what that means, very carefully, that person wouldn't understand one word of what you were saying. And yet, you are asked not just to understand one word, but to thoroughly understand the principles underlying Vedanta. Now, we are not like those people in the outside world who wouldn't understand or be interested in one word of Vedanta. We are extremely interested in Vedanta because we are interested in self-realization. We would like to trade our present lives, no matter how profitable and valuable they are. We would be delighted to change our life today and be Swami. Because Swami says, I am never in sorrow. I don't know what worry means. I am always happy. No matter what happens, I am always in bliss. So we would be willing to trade our present lives, no matter how valuable they are, for that. And that is the promise that Swami lays out to us if we follow his teachings, that we will be as he is because that is our true nature, not that we will become through practice, but that that is our nature, and that liberation is just the discovery that we have never been bound, that that is always our nature, day in and day out. Total, absolute freedom, fresh, ever-present bliss. And so we are very much interested in this topic of Vedanta because what it promises to us and what it has found and delivered to sages and saints over all the ages to show Swami's great power, the great person that he is. Perhaps one or two experiences might be in order. For example, the first couple of years that we were in India, we would stay in Bangalore at the one of the hotels, West End Hotel, and drive out every day to Swami in the morning, drive back in the noontime, because Swami goes upstairs for about 4 hours during the day, then come back again in the afternoon. Now, those were the days when there were a lot of hippies in India. Every place you went, you would see hippies. My wife and I went to Benares, and out in the Holy Ganges, just opposite all the temples, there was a boat filled with German hippies, playing their guitars and singing their hippie songs. And they also came to Swami's ashram. And he gave the hippies a lot of attention and tried to change their ways and put them to do some work even, for example, to help in the press. But they absolutely refused to do any work whatsoever. So at that time, a number of parents would write to Swami and say, Swami, our sons or daughters are in India, and would you please help us get them back? So that was the case here. This man and his wife came from New York because Swami had written to them, or had a message written, that he'd found their daughter. And so they came out in the morning, and not realizing the taxi situation, had sent their taxi back in town. So when the time came in the evening, late evening, Swami went upstairs again, and everybody left, they had no taxi. So they asked, could we ride in your taxi? So I said, of course you can. So in the taxi was the New York man, his wife, Victoria, my wife, the taxi driver, and myself. Now those of you who have been there know that there are two roads into Bangalore, the short road which turns off soon after you leave, and the longer road that goes by the airport. So the driver turned off on the short road. Now, it so happened that they were repairing that road, and there was a mound of earth, probably as high as my shoulder, all along one side of the road, which there was repair material. So we were behind a bus, and the taxi driver, being impatient, wanted to pass the bus. So he pulled around and looked, and he saw a single light ahead. And he thought, well, that is some car standing still. So he pulled around, and he put on the gas, as much as you can put the gas on in an ambassador Indian car. And nothing much happens. But given time, the car picked up speed. And no sooner did he do that and start to pick up a bit of speed than we realized to our horror that that car that he had seen and made a judgment about, he was totally wrong. That was a car coming directly at us at a very high rate of speed. Now, when you're faced with a head-on collision, usually one of the cars will take to the ditch because there's at least a chance of survival. But here, that couldn't be done. Here was the bus on the left side, and here was this big row of earth material on the right side. No possibility of getting off that road, and here were these two cars coming like that. As soon as we pulled around, and the lights flashed through the windscreen and sort of blinded us, we like that because we expected death any minute. But nothing happened, so we opened our eyes and looked behind us, and there in the taillight of our car, we could see through the taillight of our car, and we could see the taillight of that other car receding and going away from us. How could such a thing happen? Absolutely impossible. Swami had to distort or change both time and space. So the next morning, we went out early, and when Swami came down, I threw myself at his feet. He said, "Swamiji, we thank you for saving our lives last night." And Swamiji laughed, and he said, yes, he said, "You were really scared." He said, "And you were so scared you even didn't think to call on Swami. But Swami saved you anyway." And so then he turned to it. At that time, there were always several Telugu doctors, or great devotees of his, sitting on the wall of the veranda. And so he turned to these Telugu doctors and told them the whole story. And I said to Swami, "Swami, you must have changed both space and time." And he just laughed and refused to answer entirely. Another story that I should tell you, again showing the fantastic power and majesty of Swami. When we first went to Prasanthi Nilayam, we were 25, 26 years ago, January 1968. There weren't any new buildings at all, just a bunch of old buildings, and the mandir without the extension to the veranda that it now has and the various improvements. And there were, I think, 8 Westerners on the campus, and not more than 35 or 40 Indians in their very early days. So they put the ladies in one old room and the men in another old room to sleep. And then they said, "Swami will come and visit you in about 15 or 20 minutes. So Swami came in, and we were sitting on the floor. And he started to walk back and forth in front of us. In the most graceful way, just seemed to float on the floor with his great big lustrous eyes and a beautiful smile on his mouth, just floating back and forth across the floor. So I'd heard about this man who could change your life and never change back again. And I sort of lost consciousness of the world under the room and sunk deep, deep into myself. And then I became aware of a movement in my heart, very faint, like maybe the wind from the wings of a butterfly, very faint movement. Then I realized that that was love, that movement was love. Then I realized, no, that is Swami in my heart as the Lord of love. Realized it so clearly. So since that day, I have been a devotee of Swami. I had always thought of myself as an intellectual, because I was interested only in intellectual subjects. But I found to my surprise that I was a devotee on that day, and I've been Swami's devotee ever since. So in those early days, we were in one room, my wife and I, later on, facing Swami's mandir and the window in the mandir. And he would look out occasionally and beckon to me like that. Come on up, Hyslop, let us talk. So he would beckon me, and I would go up into his room and sit down with him, and we would chat. And so one time I said to Swami, Swami, you have to take care of your devotees every place. And I know from stories I've heard by now that you take care of the devotees of God, whether the person knows you or not. And you have to care for all of your schools, too. How do you have the time to sit here and talk to the likes of me? Is that a fair question? It's a fair question, wasn't it? And so Swami said, well, Hyslop is not like that. He said, when you, for example, get into your car and you turn the key, then the car starts to run and it doesn't need any more attention. You don't have to do anything about it. You start it running and it keeps on running. And so he said, the unit is like that, Hyslop with Swami. Swami turns the key, so to speak, and the universe runs itself. So I have lots of time to be sitting here talking to the likes of you. And so I said, well, Swami, then are you in different form and different places to carry on the work? And he said, no, no, certainly not. He said, there's only one avatar. But now, Hyslop, tell me about the rays of the sun. Are the rays of the sun any different from the sun itself? So I had to say, no, Swami, no different. The rays of the sun are like the sun itself. So he said, well, Swami's influence goes out like that. But there's only Swami, no one else. He made a very important statement there. The statement was that everything that happens is automatic. Karma, everything that happens is because it's bound to happen. The engine is bound to keep running. And therefore, where is free will? He said that anyone who is born into this world is certainly not free. He said if there's the slightest limitation on what any person does, how can you call it freedom? So therefore, one of his very important teachings is, accept as my will all that happens. Whatever happens in life is God's will. And the events are brought about by causes. There is no event without a prior cause. And each cause is followed by an event. So we might think then that we are doomed by this ever-flowing stream of karma, as the Buddha has his wheel, his revolving wheel of life, where each act is the cause which fuels the next act, and the wheel revolves eternally. But Swami says that no, all those things caused by karma, all the events, the actions that you did in the past that have now brought about a karmic result. He said if they were bad actions and you have a bad result, is what you're always complaining about, the bad results that come to you. He said those actions taken by yourself, which have bad consequences, those actions were mostly made just as a mistake or made through ignorance, not through malevolence. And so they can be changed. Because in this present split moment is eternity. The past moment is the history. Just a memory. Gone. Gone. The next moment is just in a thought. It hasn't arrived yet. It doesn't have any existence. The only thing that has existence is this present moment. now, this present moment. So in this present moment, if you engage yourself in good actions, Swami says that my entire life is given to seva. So plunge fully into seva. One way to change the course of karma is like people who have a garden and raise flowers and vegetables. They make a trench to put in the seeds and then cover the seeds with soil and water the soil. And the flowers and the vegetables come up. But if you put too much dirt, too thick dirt, on top of the row of seeds, they won't sprout. They won't come up. So doing good, honest things, true things, things of which you wouldn't be ashamed to see Swami view, that is like putting so much good deeds on top of the karma, the bad deeds, that they don't have a chance to sprout. So there's no doubt at all that you can change your karma. Totally and completely. Now, I'll tell you how, totally and completely, according to Swami's statement. He said that, suppose you hear, tat tvam asi, which means that thou art, that being the absolute divinity, that thou art divinity, thou art the absolute. That's the statement. So he said, when you hear that, why aren't you God immediately? But you don't do it. So, absolute statement from Swami that the entire river of karma can be set aside and completely done away with just by immediately turning to the fact of the truth, Tatvamasi, that I am, God I am. So much for karma. Now, Swami said that this seemingly endless course of events in which we are engaged, in our homes, endless events, in business, endless events, on the street, endless events, studying, going to college, getting married, having family, having accidents, all that great mix-max of human life. We call the current of life, the river of life. Swami said that that is impersonal. That river of life in which we are so profoundly caught up. And having heard that it's possible to be free of that river of life and be always free, it changes us from ordinary human beings to Satya Sai Baba devotees. And he said, that river of life, that endless river of experience, is not you. It's just the process of nature, which has its own meaning and its own business, its own concern. That to identify ourselves with all the things that happen in our life, is to say that we are those events. Swami says, no, not so. That at all times we are divinity, entirely apart from, entirely free from those events, just the witnesser, the witnessing of all those events. Now, the difference between the witness and the doer, the conviction that we are the doer, is what binds us to this river of experience. If, on the contrary, we step aside from that and say that all these happenings are the result of karma, and karma is the Lord, Swami turns the switch on his engine and the whole thing runs. He's responsible for the whole thing. You could say karma or God, almost interchangeably. So Swami says, advises us to accept everything that happens as God's will, to bear with it with patient courage, to bear with it using patient courage, and to then engage in self-inquiry, so we may know directly who we are. See, the trouble is, now, we know all these things indirectly. We hear Swami talk, or we read what Swami says in a book, or we find out what Astravaka, sage Astravaka, said to King Janaka, or what Vasishtha said to Lord Rama, or what Baba says in a speech, or what Baba says to us personally. So all we know is that indirect knowledge, book knowledge, what somebody says. And that's like the wind, hits you and passes and is gone. So what does Swami say? He says that you must exchange this indirect knowledge for direct knowledge. Now, for example, I have these small notes, in case I forget and have to look at my notes. And that is direct knowledge. That is, I know. I don't have to have Swami tell me, or your good selves tell me, or anybody in this world tell me that I have some notes here in my hand, pieces of paper in my hand. I know it. I'll stand up against anybody on that. I know directly that I have these papers in my hand. Now, that's somewhat different from indirect knowledge. Indirect knowledge is, well, he said so, or she said so, or God said so, or somebody else said so. So Swami tells us that for all this indirect knowledge, all this believing and identification with the body and so on, that has to be put aside, and you must now substitute direct knowledge. And for that, we start that path with the path of self-inquiry. And we find, once we start the path of self-inquiry, that we identify ourselves with the body. Natural, normal. I identify myself. Here's Hyslop sitting here talking all this nonsense. And you see yourself, I'm sitting here listening to the speaker. So we are identifying with a particular person. I'm identifying with this person, and you're identifying with the person that you are. Now, Swami says that that is original sin. If we want to know what original sin is, I don't know how you'd interpret it to Adam and Eve, but Swami says that original sin is the belief that you are the body. From that, all the torrent of wrong ideas and wrong actions starts and continues, with that identification that we are the body. Now, he tells us that you can understand, perhaps in this way. We all notice that we have a shadow. And when we are out walking, our shadow has all sorts of experiences. It's of a certain size. It's mixed up and muddled, or it's sort of supreme. It goes along the street. It's run over by a car. It goes through a swamp and goes through this muddy water. All these things happen to our shadow. Its career, its life, its day-to-day experience. All those things are happening to the shadow. And yet, we don't even react. Here's our poor shadow. It gets run over by a car. Do we stop and weep for the shadow? Or rush the shadow to a doctor? No. Because we know that the shadow is not ourselves. We don't identify with the shadow. So Swami says that the shadow is like yourself as a person. Just as the shadow is, so is yourself as a person. It has no more reality, nor does it merit any more concern than does the shadow. That is, you don't make your shadow the center of your life. And yet, the body is directly compared to the shadow. If we are detached, which I'll tell you about in a moment, then we can see just as readily as our eyes now see the business with the shadow. Then we can see that exactly the same as with our worldly life. Now, two people start to argue, and you're the third person. Now, normally, you wouldn't be joining in the argument. If they are striking each other, you wouldn't get into the fight. If they're calling each other names, you wouldn't join in. As the witness, the third person watching those events, they are all outside you. You don't identify with those events. You don't say it's happening to me. You're simply watching those things happen. You are the seer, and that is the seen. And as a seer, you are not the seen. Two are quite separate. And therefore, if you can, through self-inquiry, start to look at that situation and start to see that you as awareness, that is, the witness is aware of what is happening, but doesn't associate or identify with it. So if you can become aware of what is happening to you, that is, instead of immediately identifying with what is happening to yourself, as would the witness if he jumped into the fight. But if you, as the witness, then, can start to see what is happening to you in the way of experience every day, as being that which is seen, and you, somehow or other, are seeing that happening. You're aware of that happening. You're not part of it, you're aware of it happening. So then, as we find that is true, we can see it's true, that I lost my sunglasses and they found them for me. And I identified it immediately, oh, my brand new sunglasses that I bought yesterday when it was with Bill, they're gone. See, I identified with that situation. So this is a very, very important point, and I hope that you will give it some attention. The aspect of yourself as the witness, combined with Swami's very clear statement that all that's happening in our life, hour by hour, day by day, that is just the impersonal course of nature. Nature has its own purpose to serve. And that which appears before you, the seen, is not the seer. You are the witness, the seer. The seer is not that which he witnesses. Now, just we'll start that and try that a little bit. Then you will see that while your life, your experience, yourself, myself as Hislop, changes constantly, yet my awareness of what is happening never changes. Before the event of my losing my sunglasses, I was aware that I had the glasses. Then, after I lost them, I was aware that I had lost the glasses. Then they were returned to me, and I was aware the glasses were returned to me. So I look at that awareness. Has that awareness changed from the time I lost my glasses to the time that I have my glasses? No, it hasn't. The awareness, your awareness, before what happens, during what happens, and after what happens, is totally unchanged by anything whatsoever. Now, if you ask the question, who am I? Self-inquiry. Who am I? And you see this situation before you. You experience it. Here is my life in which things are happening all the time and changing me. Everything that happens to me changes me in one way or another. So here is the events of my life, and then here is the awareness of those events. Now, the awareness never changes. It's always the same. The events change continually, never the same. So if I'm looking for myself, am I more likely to be that which never changes, or that which is constantly changing and therefore non-identifiable? Surely, in common sense, you would say, more likely, I am the awareness,
which doesn't change. You try. You try. You experience yourself as the witness. You watch and see yourself being the witness. And you'll see that there was no change whatsoever before, during, and after that which was witnessed. The witness remains the same. Then maybe your thoughts will flash back to your memory, your earliest memory of yourself as a child. I'm sure you could do it. I can do it. I remember myself a little child playing out in front of the lawn in Canada with the family dog. And I see that my awareness then is precisely the same as it is today. I haven't learned anything. I'm exactly the same as I was then. No change whatsoever. So therefore, that awareness is more my true self than this life that changes continuously. Now, to give you a viewpoint on what Swami says about that. Whenever I go to Prasanthi Nilayam, you know, they have those talks in the morning to keep the foreigners off the streets. Yeah? And so whenever I go there, they always tag me. I have to give some of those talks. And so I gave some talks, and the listeners, the audience, wanted a solid session of questions and answers. So I agreed. And so we had a solid session of questions and answers. Now, at that time, I was sitting on the veranda and right up close to Swami's door because nobody else had observed that seat for the time being. Very close to Swami's door on the veranda. And he was then interviewing the editor of Sanatana Sarathi almost every day, and they're talking about what we're going to Sanatana Sarathi. And Swami was calling him in. And so then, when I came, sitting up in front, he would call me in with the editor. And then he would always have in there maybe somebody else like Mr. Rottenlaw or somebody else. And so I could sit there and listen to him talking to these people. And sometimes he would let me ask him questions, too. So, one time I was sitting there, and so Swami moved his hand like that. And I'd been telling Swami that my wife had been ill. He says, every time your wife has a pain, you come and complain to Swami. Which was probably the truth. And so he moved his hand and produced a lingam. And he said, now, notice this lingam. That there's a line right through the middle, like a wedge coming down. And on one side it looks one way, and the other side it looks the other way. So what Swami has created for you is the lingam for you and your wife. Now, your wife is this side, and you are this side. And so every morning you put a little bit of water on it and drink that water. Then he kept it in his hand. And disappeared. And then he moved his hand again like that, and there appeared on his hand really an extraordinary object. Looked like it was made of glass. And Swami said, this is Shakti. He said, this is a very, very important. Had a base, and then a narrow stem, and then sort of a bulbous top, and then another stem coming from it. Very strange looking. Full of power, the most powerful thing that exists. Would you like to have this, sister? So I said, well, Swami, I don't know, the other lingam is for both of us. And so then, immediately, the lingam, this new one, disappeared. And he said, Hislop, you didn't make up your mind soon enough. So I had the divided lingam. And so then a little later on in the conversation, I said to Swami, couldn't I have both of them? And so Swami, he said, Hislop, you're incorrigible. He said, all right. And then he made the Shakti again and gave them both to me. So at any rate, I was called in almost every day. And after I'd given this question and answer session, I was called in too. And Swami addressed me immediately. He said, "Hislop, all you did was confuse those people." The big question and answer session. So I said, "Well, Swami, what do you mean I confused them?" And he said, "Well, they would ask a question, and you would answer it from the standpoint of Adatta, which they didn't understand at all. And then they would ask another question based on what they didn't understand in the first place." So it was nothing but confusion. So he said, "Your answers were good, but that's not their medicine. What Swami teaches day by day is their medicine." So then the next day, the Italians asked me to talk to them. And they were had their talk in a shed a long ways away, on this side of the cafeteria and the big round buildings, quite a long distance from Swami's office. And so when we had the conversation then, finished the conversation about that I had done nothing but confuse the people, I said, "Well, Swami, here's this room, and there's just one small window there. And that lecture hall was a long ways away. How do you know, Swami? How did you know what I said and what the people thought and what they said?" How could he? He's sitting in that room with high walls. And this lecture hall's a long distance away. You couldn't possibly hear anything. And certainly not see anything. So, Swami, how could you know that? How did you go there, Swami? Did you go as Ishvara?" He said, "No, Hislop. I was there as omnipresent awareness. That is my nature. That awareness that we have of ourselves and of what is happening around us, that awareness is Swami." He said, "I am that awareness, omnipresent awareness. Whereas our awareness seems to be linked a little bit to the whereabouts of our body, Swami doesn't have that limitation. He is awareness every place. If I have been able to convey one thing to you, and that is engage in self-inquiry and find out who am I. Look at your life day by day and see, who am I? Now, if you find out that you are not the experience and the experiencer, but you are the witness of what happens, not in any way affected by the experiencer and the experience, then there has been a tremendous step made on the path of self-realization." So now we're supposed to have a few minutes of questions and answers. Shall we start?
I had a couple of questions. One on what you're speaking about with the first step of enlightenment or initial step in learning about the witness. Could you tell us what would come after that? And also, could you comment on anything Swami might have said about the Theosophical Society? Because I know you were a member of that.
Yeah. No, Swami, I never asked Swami about the Theosophical Society. And so, therefore, he didn't make any comment to me. On the other point, Swami appears in dreams, doesn't he? To almost all of us. One time or another, Swami will appear in our dream. And yet he says that a dream is just a dream. And when the dreamer disappears, as is the case when the illusion of dream stops, then that dreamer is not lost, but it reappears as the waking person, who has nothing whatsoever to do with the persona of the dreamer. So I said to Swami, "Well, Swami, you say that this waking state is just a dream too, a longer dream, but no less a dream than the dreaming dream. You say, Swami, that this waking state is a dream, but we see you in that dream, working hard every moment. Why do you do that?" dream activity in a dream. What could be more useless than constructing something in a dream, and when you're going to wake up 5 minutes from now, it has no reality? And here's Swami, the Lord himself, working like all out in this waking dream. So I said, Swami, how come then, if it's a dream, you're working so hard? He said, Hislop, I appear in your dream to help you wake up. To help us wake up from this waking dream. Because this is a dream, just as is the sleeping dream. You see, if I had a dream last night, how can I escape from all the things that are happening to me in that dream? Can I escape in any way except by waking up? My freedom from the dream is my ability to wake up from the dream. Isn't that right? Only thing I can do to get myself out of all the troubles that I'm in that dream is to wake up. So it's the same thing with this waking state. The only way to get rid of all the troubles in which we're engaged now, trying to reach liberation, trying to realize ourselves, making a living and so forth and so on, is to wake up from the dream. Then Swami says that when the fiction of ourself as part of this illusion of the waking state disappears, the actor in this waking state will then appear as his true self, the Atma. Just as the dreamer of the night's dream appears as his true self, as the dreamer. Man sleeping in bed, dreaming. Likewise in this waking state. We wake up from the waking state to our true identity, which is God, divinity itself.
I guess my burning desire is to hear about what Baba's talked about animals and how our relation with them and why we should, any discussions you have with them.
Yes, the question was that what does Swami have to say about animals and our relationship with animals? Swami's relationship with animals, if we wish to take that as a model, is that he has great compassion for animals. He very often has a small dog that he keeps. And we all know about Gita, who loves Swami with all her heart. And I said to him one time, Swami, people say that Gita was an Indian princess who took birth again to be near you. He said, nonsense. Pure nonsense. He said, Gita was never a human being, but she will be a human being in her next birth. So therefore, Swami sees animals as very little different from human beings. As he sees even a rock, for example, the story of the saris in India, the weeping saris. The saris were conscious, aware. He says there's nothing that doesn't have awareness, nothing that doesn't have life. So, but nevertheless, he is also very strict with animals. They have to behave themselves. Now, there was a cobra living on the campus there at Vrindavan. And Swami told the cobra, you can stay here, but don't kill anything in this camp. So, time went by, and then people came to Swami and said, Swami, the cobra ate a rat. And Swami said, kill it. Just like that. So animals have to also do their proper life, their proper dharma. Dharma exists for animals as it does for man. So that, Swami always has deer at Vrindavan. You know, he has a great big compound full of all sorts of deer and geese, and then he has a great bunch of cages full of all kinds of birds. So he's very much aware of the animal kingdom. Next question. What do you see?
It's the dharma of a snake to eat rats, so why was the snake violating Swami?
Well, that's what you say, but apparently Swami didn't. Apparently Swami didn't agree with it, doesn't agree with that. The snake wasn't the snake's dharma, no. In fact, the snake had been specifically instructed not to do that.
Dr. Hislop, this is a very important part to me that you made about awareness. And I think I understood you to say that you could get rid of your karma by always realizing that you are awareness. Did I get that right?
you can get rid of your karma by keeping your mind on God at all times. Then everything else fades away into insignificance. Now the Buddha, you know, the Buddha had his monks. And they also were worried about karma. And so to a great assemblage of his monks, one time the Buddha gave this teaching. He said that your karma is like a string of beads that you are pulling behind you. They are not following you. You are pulling the beads behind you. And whenever you wish, you can let loose of the string of beads and they will disappear. So in the same way, at any moment you can realize yourself as your true nature divinity, and everything that happens, whether karma plays itself out or not, will have nothing to do with you, because you are free. You are the observer. You are the Lord.
In that sense, if you are aware of something that you're doing, and it might not be exactly right, does that karma still accumulate, although you realize that you are God and you're doing something that is not appropriate?
If you engage, Swami says, if you engage in any evil action, you may be sure that sooner or later the consequences will follow. Now, was it due to foolishness on your part, just a stupid action, or was it a malevolent action? Swami says that intention is more important than the event itself. Intention. And that's illustrated by the common story of the robber who stabs somebody and the surgeon who stabs somebody. One gets jailed, the other one gets rich.
I've heard it written and said in a couple of places that towards the end of Swami's life on earth, that some two-thirds to three-quarters of the human race, including essentially all religions, will become devotees of Swami. Have you heard any such thing?
My understanding of his statement there, the question was, did you all hear the question? Maybe not. The question was that has Swami ever said anything about all the people of the world coming to his feet before his death? He said that during my lifetime, the entire world will come to my feet and the Muslims will be the last.
Has Swami said anything about creation and how he created and in what order?
One time I was there in Vrindavan, and my wife and I were about to go home. So Swami moved his hand like that and turned his hand, and there was a great big mass of sugar candy. And Swami said, look, look, you can see the water still there changing into the sugar. So Swami, you can see it. The actual act of creation going on. And it came from the water. You know the sequence? Space, fire, what's the next one? Air, water, earth. So the last two in the sequence of creation, water and earth, were demonstrated right there before us on his hand. And then another similar situation was that long ago he made a ring for me. We were having an interview with a bunch of nuns from Amayananda. And he made a ring. And I thought he was made it for the nuns who were in there. Why I was there with a bunch of nuns, I don't know, but I was sitting here with a bunch. He must have invited me in. And so then he turned and gave it to me, this ring. It was a typical Indian ring with 9 different stones. And the metal, the composite metal of 5 metals that they use in India. So at that time we were staying in Bangalore. So we went back to our hotel room, and in the morning when I woke up and wanted to admire the ring again, the pearl was missing. Wasn't there. So my wife and I crawled under the bed and we looked every place. There was no stone. So when I got back out to Vrindavan, I said, Swami, I must have done something horribly wrong, because Swami has already taken one of the stones away. And Swami said, no, no, Hislop, it's not that. He said, when I was creating the ring, the thought crossed my mind, is this an appropriate ring for Hyslop? Do you see the importance of that? For a moment, his concentration had fluctuated, and the process of creation was interfered with. You see, Swami makes all these artifacts for people. You probably, most of you who have been to Vrindavan, have one of these artifacts, maybe a ring or watch or something. And the question is, how come? Where do they come from? And so Swami says, well, I don't apport them, bring them to some place else. My workers make them. And so what does that mean? Well, now, the thought is made up of atoms, of energy of some sort. Thought is made up of energy. And that energy is something that vibrates at various frequencies and so forth. Hmm? Likewise, an object, this watch. And this is also made of material, which also vibrates at various frequencies and various wavelengths. Now, with a master of creation like Swami, what's so hard about Swami just changing the vibration of the air, for example, and the frequency of the atoms in the air to the frequency and vibratory rate of the metal in a ring? No problem at all for Swami. Next question?
Dr. Hyslop, I know that prayer can have a tremendous effect, but I'm curious about what actually happens when we pray for another, and, you know, what actually transpires. Does Swami change his will for that person? And the second part of the question would be, what is the most effective way to pray for another?
I asked Swami about prayer, and he said, this is a very important answer. Swami warned me, an important answer was coming up. So he said that it's very important to pray, and for what you need, or even for what you want. But the prayer should be in a good, loud voice. That is, don't just mumble or just think. But he said a good, loud voice. I don't know how loud he meant you should shout, but that's what he said, a good, loud voice. And he said, for example, the mother knows very well that the small child is hungry or will be hungry. But she knows the child must have food. But she doesn't rush to feed the child until the child cries out. Then she rushes to feed the child. So it's the same with Swami answering a prayer. Furthermore, he said, another very important statement. He said, do not turn away in sad despair if God does not answer your request immediately. Keep praying until you have persuaded God to give you what you want. That happens in a family, doesn't it? The kid yowls and until he gets what he wants. So the same thing is the relationship between you, the child, and the Lord, the Father. Now I asked Swami, in terms of part of your last question, what is the proper way to pray? I asked Swami, well, Swami, is there any particular time or circumstances that you should pray in? Because people say that you should be at some quiet time. Swami said, no, Hyslop. He said, maybe at first for you to feel comfortable you would do that, but that's not at all necessary. You can pray to Swami in the middle of the street. Next question.
Dr. Hyslop?
Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you if you had ever asked Swami about anything of a prophetic nature regarding the course of world events, that's number one. And number two, has he ever said anything to you about his possibly coming to America?
That is, has Swami said anything to me about events that may come to pass? And what has he said about him coming to America? See, when I was the active head of the organization, and I would come to the meetings, people would ask all sorts of things, and most of them I didn't have the right answer. And so next time I would go to India, then I would ask Swami what the answer was. I said, Swami, some people have come to America just recently, And they say that you had a man in for an interview, and you told that man that New Zealand was going to disappear beneath the waters, and a land bridge would arise to Australia, and that California was going to fall into the Pacific Ocean. Swami says, absolute nonsense, Hislop. I said nothing of the kind. He said the ordinary geological events will occur, earthquakes and hurricanes and so on, but Hislop, most of those are caused by human misdoing. So, when you hear a prophecy said from Swami that some great thing is going to happen, better guess a second time. Because every time, and I must have asked Swami half a dozen times over the years, every time his answer was exactly right. I never said anything like that. All right, now the other half of the question was about coming to America. You know, one time, we were sure he was coming. He said he was coming. And we got his approval to rent university buildings in San Diego as against in Los Angeles. He approved that. So we went ahead and rented the buildings and entered into an agreement. And then events changed in Swami's world. What do we know about Swami's world? How can we say, you know, what events are? But something happened that changed his mind, and he didn't come. So the next year, and a couple of years thereafter, I kept on asking him, Swami, the devotees asked me this. The last time I said, Swami, the devotees asked me, when are you coming to America? Swami's response was, what? Don't they know I've already been there? So he's here all the time, every day. In fact, recent years, in the last 10 years, there have been a number of stories of him appearing in the house and playing with the children and things like that. So he's been here. Next question.
You said that you could, by doing good in your life, you can perhaps cover up anything you may be going through as a karma. Has anything been said to you by Swami, or do you know anything about, for instance, children who may be having, may be afflicted with something, perhaps mentally retardation, or no speech, or maybe crippled or whatnot? If the families are praying for them in a loud voice, as you said, how do they themselves communicate? How can they do good deeds, for instance, if they're, you know?
You see, to the small, innocent children, many disasters happen. We know that here in America and other parts of the world, too. Terrible things happen. How could a small child, how could that happen to him? So, one time, some time ago, a lady with a small son came into Prasanthi Nilayam. And the boy had been wearing part of the family fortune around his neck, which I guess is the case sometimes in Indian villages. They haven't got any bank to store stuff, so they have the gold in the family. So this boy was wearing one of his mother's golden chains. So two robbers came and took the necklace, and to keep the boy from identifying them, they gouged out both of his eyes. And so the mother came to seek help from Swami. Compassion from Swami. Maybe do something to give the eyes, his eyesight back. But Swami told the mother, he said, Mother, this little boy, your small son, in his last life was a very, very cruel man. And he gouged out the eyes of at least half a dozen people during his lifetime. So Swami does not see this little boy just as you see him. But if as time goes on, and this boy realizes that something terrible happened to him, and that he in turn must have done something terrible to deserve that, and starts to feel real genuine remorse, then if there is that genuine remorse, then Swami may forgive him and do something to help him. So that has to be said about what happens even to small little children. It's the result of karma. But karma can be set aside, or largely set aside, by the further lifetime activities of that person.